listen, let me tell you a story about a village that is built with his glory. No sorrow in this place, just lift your voice and say, let's celebrate. Look like it's gonna be a lovely day. Come on everybody, let's celebrate. Forget your worries, throw your problems away. Come on everybody, let's celebrate. Show your smile, show your smile now. Everybody, let's celebrate. Oh, 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 oh. Let's celebrate.
Hello and welcome to the Village Celebration. I'm Vicki Newton. Today we're talking about a new report released by the Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Equality. And the study reveals that black girls are viewed as being older than their white peers, less in need of protection and nurturing. The authors of this report, called Girlhood Interrupted, say this process is adultification of young girls. And joining me is the founder of a Chicago program called Girls Like Me, Lakeisha Gray Sewell, who's a well-known and unapologetic advocate for girls. Lakeisha, thank you for being with me.
Thank you for addressing this topic and for delving in. I'm honored to be a part of the conversation.
What is your opinion of this report?
I think it's factual. Mm-hmm. I think it is something that, unfortunately, at the end of the day, it is a report, and it is being used and was authored by those who obviously have an agenda or who have their own intention for it. But the reality is, and the very sad and devastating reality is, that it is reality for girls every day who have to deal with all of the things that were laid out. The being looked at as not being innocent, the being suspended, the being looked at as more criminal, more aggressive. These are things that girls have to navigate their realities through every single day, be it if it's interpersonal or if it's just through systemic policies. Mm. These are the things that oppress the girlhood of girls, black girls.
And so you mentioned the suspension. Listen to this. Black girls are 5 times more likely to be suspended than white girls, twice as likely to be suspended as white boys. Black girls make up less than 16% of the female school population, but they account for 28% of referrals to law enforcement and 37% of the arrests. Meanwhile, white girls account for 50% of the female school population, only 30% of referrals and 30% of arrests. What's happening?
What's happening is that America is imploding on itself. And I believe that white supremacy has penetrated every part of our families, and what's left, the only messages that are left are to go after our children. And black girls are absolutely feeling the brunt of it. And I can tell you, Vicki, that I'm no shame of my age. I can tell you that at 41, these are the very same things that over 25 years ago I experienced myself. The aggressive suspension, the aggressive referrals and detentions, the aggressive disciplinary actions, the discrimination to even push us out of schools, right? Mm-hmm. That was my reality as a high school student. It's also the reality that I see with girls now, especially as in Chicago. I'm not sure if your audience is aware, but 54 schools were closed in Chicago alone in one school year. 54 schools serving predominantly black girls and Latina girls. 54 schools that were obviously underperforming, but were also in this space of segregation. Mm-hmm. School systems here are based on, let's just say, the predominantly white the population, the better the school services. So if parents are trying to find school options, one, because their school is closed, or two, because they want to have more competitive curriculum, they want more diversity, they want a better educational experience for their children, they are then forced to reckon with the very fact that they're putting their child into an oppressive and the very ideal bills that are found in this report, they're basically sending their children into this kind of aggressive territory.
So let's go to this part of the report that identifies when the significant bias starts. According to this report, when little girls are as young as five, society starts to see them as needing less protection and being more grown. And, you know, sometimes I don't know that we help this and we say, oh, she's fast.
Mm.
That type of talk.
Mm-hmm.
Is this what you're seeing?
And we can say five because I'm sure this is where their research led them. But we can look in preschool. I don't know if you recall the story of the little girl who the teacher called the police on her because she said that she stole candy off of her desk.
Mm.
I've never taken anything off my teacher's desk, but I know plenty of people who did.
Sure.
And even from our parents, right? You want that apple that your mother told you couldn't have, and then you sneak off and you get the apple before you are corrected and taught, right, at very early ages.
Mm-hmm.
We can also see this. You know, if we just go into a doctor's office, a pediatrician's office, right, and we see young black babies and their counterparts, we see that black girls are forced, really, to repress their girlhood, right? They can't play. They can't giggle loudly. They can't go and get all the games that they want to play with at once. They have to be very quiet and pretty much invisible, right? Whereas white toddlers are encouraged to explore. They're encouraged to take up space. And our girls are encouraged to collapse on themselves and to censor themselves, even at early ages as toddlers in pediatric facilities. This may be a report that is coming out, and you know, we use that term report and research, but this is absolutely devastating. It is absolutely the arrested development of our girls. And if we do not address this as more than, if every news outlet, every space that has a platform, this needs to be front and center. We are killing the spirit of our future. Because when you have the arrested development of girlhood, this then impacts their children, right? Girls do grow up to become women, correct?
Correct.
And if you've done this damage to them as children, how much of it will then be translated into their children's lives, into their community's lives, into their families, into the spaces that they take up in terms of work and professionalism? This has a huge impact, not just to one girl, but to girlhood all over the globe.
I'm speechless because what you say is so critical, and you see it happening. To your point that it sets the tone for the rest of a young girl's life, this study found that by the age of 15, the playing field levels in the way that girls are perceived. Black and white girls are then perceived more along the same lines. But by then, the die is cast, as you pointed out a moment ago. What can we do?
I want to answer that, but I also want to say to that as well. Society may then see them on level playing fields at that point in time, but for that girl, that individual girl, she does not see herself as on an individual playing field. Now she has to repair the damage that has been done psychologically and to her fundamental sense of being. She has to repair that. And there are not spaces that are dedicated to that repair. There are no spaces dedicated to the healing and to the consistent nurturing of that girl's spirit as it is being broken, as it is being vilified. So what we can do is, one, create those spaces while they are in it, not at the end of it, but while they are in it, right now in their girlhood. Our schools should have in place peace circles, should have healing circles. There needs to be more focus on on individual self-worth and awareness. There needs to be more connection to history and history that has been made by black women and black girls. There needs to be intentional curriculum around these systems and these systemic prejudices, whether or not black girls are in your midst or not. So whether your school or your space is if you target or you serve black girls, it doesn't matter. You should still have a space dedicated to speaking about inclusion and speaking about the equity of treatment. You should have a space that celebrates all cultures, whether they are represented or not. And I also think that there needs to be more representation, right? So there needs to be more representation that we have got to break down the segregation that takes place in schools due to, and when I say segregation, not just race, but class as well, right? We know oftentimes black families have to make 2 to 3 times as much as the white families that they are near when they're in schools, even to get the access to it, right? I think that we need to do more to get girls in, to normalize us in these spaces where people don't see black girls. And the only time they see us is on the news when we're being pulled out and dragged out of a pool in McKinney, Texas. Or the only time they see us is on a fight video that's gone viral. They don't see us normalized. And if they encounter to that, then it's an exceptionalism, as in a Malia or Sasha Obama. There's no middle ground for us to be our black, beautiful, brilliant, creative, innovative, sassy selves. And so I think we need to be more focused on normalizing us. And I also think that in these spaces, there needs to be more women of color, black women, in administrative positions and in those positions that actually have the responsibility to dole out disciplinary actions and resolution.
There's a lot to be done, but your point that we need to reach them while they're in this girlhood mm-hmm. space is what I hope resonates with our listeners today.
I hope so, too. And I want to say, Vicki, that it's not just the job of people like myself who have organizations who mentor girls. It's not just the job of the schools. It is all of our jobs. It is our jobs as educators. It is our jobs as policymakers and elected officials. It is our job as media to make sure that we're creating a narrative that is inclusive, that is truthful, right, and representative of all of us. So I thank you as a person in the media for lifting this story up, delving into it, and hopefully considering a series to continue this conversation and even hearing from girls themselves to tell you how this impacts their lives. I cannot tell you. As an adult woman, I can put it in perspective now. I can say that it made me stronger. I can give you all these rational outcomes that came out of my experience, but when I was in it, and I cried for the little girl that I was, when I was in it, that feeling of being powerless, that feeling of being discounted, that feeling of having to prove double time your worth, it is the most crippling, the most anger, it makes you angry, and so you become an angry black woman. So it's very real, Vicki, and I hope that we do heed the truth of it, and that we need to all hands on deck lift up our girls and heal them.
Well, in the village, we are on board. Lakeisha Gray Sewell, the founder of Girls Like Me, joining us to discuss this very disturbing report released by Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Equality, saying that black girls are being adultified at such young ages. The word itself shouldn't even be in the same sentence with a 5-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And we'll be right back.
The recent events in our country have created a grassroots effort to reallocate assets in a way that sustains and supports the African American community. Some are calling this movement Making Black or Move Our Money. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce, or USBC, and Liberty Bank have partnered to offer a credit card with a 9.9% interest rate. The U.S. Black Chambers and Liberty Bank, working together in our community. For more information on the credit card, visit libertybank.net/affinity. Use promo code USBC.
Hi, Amanda. How are you?
Doing really well. How are you settling into your new job?
I like the company and I really like the town. Just having a hard time finding places for my dry cleaning, car repairs, and restaurant. And I really want to support Black-owned businesses.
Have you tried the app created by the U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce? It connects you to Black-owned businesses all around the country.
Sounds great.
It is. It helps you locate Black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's exactly what I need. Thanks.
For more information about the U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce mobile app, go to usblackchambers.org. Welcome back to the Village Celebration. This conversation about missing African American girls and women is making headlines nationally. The Village Celebration contributor Jonathan Clark is working on an article about the subject and joins us now with the preview. Jonathan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for the honor of having me join you.
This conversation is very distressing, and recently it swept across the country in terms of an article in the Washington, D.C. area that cited about 64,000 missing African American girls and women. What have you been able to find out about that number?
So I think the first thing we need to do is we need to look at why suddenly, or at least seemingly suddenly, we're beginning to pay attention to this topic. And it all started out back in about March when when the Washington, D.C. Police Department for the first time began placing its missing persons in social media. Which led to this perception that there were 14 missing black women, 14 women who went missing in the space of 24 hours. And that was retweeted by a number of celebrities, and it led to this tremendous outcry and this belief that a number of black women had gone missing without any sort of attention being paid to it. So it turned out that was not entirely accurate. In fact, it wasn't accurate at all.
The 14 women missing in a span of 24 hours.
Right. That did not turn out to be the case. And in fact, the Washington, D.C. police eventually explained that the numbers of missing persons there actually had gone down since 2014. But it led to this conversation that we're now having, which is trying to understand why there are so many, disproportionately so many black persons missing in comparison to the population as a whole.
And so what have you found in terms of hard data? Is this perception reality? Sort it out for us.
So it's not exactly simply a matter of perception. There are, you know, blacks represent just under 13% of the population of a whole, but they represent almost 40% of missing persons. And so you can see right there that there's the statistical data that points to the larger number of black persons who are missing as a proportion of the whole, but you wouldn't know it necessarily by watching our news coverage or by reports in the media, because the cases that tend to be popularized or the ones that tend to receive widespread coverage tend to not reflect that case. So, for example, if I said Elizabeth Smart or Natalie Holloway or Chandra Levy, or even this recent case of a 15-year-old Elizabeth Thomas who was abducted by her teacher, you almost know those names right away and can cite chapter and verse who these people are, who these young women were, and what happened to them, or at least certainly what the circumstances were surrounding their disappearances. If I said Phoenix Colden or Michaela Randall or Relisha Rudd, names like that, you probably wouldn't know. Or at least not right away, you wouldn't be familiar with who those cases are. Well, in the first cases, the first set of names, those were young white women who disappeared at various times. When they disappeared, they received widespread coverage. They became household names. We were familiar with their faces, their families, and their histories. Those other names, those are girls young women who disappeared, and remain largely unfamiliar to us, remain obscure to us. And so, why does that happen? Why is there that disparity? And there's this sense of desperation among so many that the black women and girls are missing, and no one is doing anything about this. That there's so little interest, and so that's why, even though the DC story back in March wasn't exactly what was inaccurate, it fuels this sense that there is a larger issue to be concerned about. Black women and girls are missing, and what are we going to do to start bringing more attention to that? How are we going to start getting at that issue? How are we going to start speaking to why they're missing and what's being done to recover them more actively?
I think you're spot on about what can we do and how do we create an environment that demands law enforcement investigate more aggressively when African American girls and women go missing. But again, we are a community not surprised when we see a disparity in the treatment of a black life relative to a white life.
Yeah, and so that really speaks to where we are right now. You know, we live in a divided society. A divided America. We have political divides, and our lifestyles are divided, and our incomes are divided, and very many instances, radically so. And so now we also have this pronounced racial divide with respect to missing persons, and also to the coverage of missing persons. So I keep coming back to this sense of coverage, and that's something that keeps showing up in my research. It's not just a sense that these cases of young black girls aren't being covered, but there's data to suggest that really is the case.
In 2004, the late Gwen Ifill, PBS journalist,
right, precisely,
first brought our attention to this in more of a public way. Tell us about her work.
Right. The renowned broadcaster Gwen Ifill back in 2004 was speaking at the Unity Journalists of Color Conference, and she coined this term called the missing white woman syndrome. And basically that's this phrase that suggests that there's a disparity in media coverage between missing white women and missing persons of color. There's a predominance of coverage involving young white upper middle class women or girls in the United States and Canada and even the United Kingdom, and that much of this coverage, this focus might be undue on this subsection of women. It's more disproportionate, the degree of coverage that they receive compared to, you know, even missing men or women of color and of different social classes. There's so much that factors into that as well. Mm-hmm. We start looking at these you know, certain factors, our understanding of attractiveness and body style and this understanding of what is beauty, as you know, the way that Americans measure beauty. And you know, come as no surprise to you that since television drives so much of this coverage, you know, what makes a good story? What appears to make a good story? Mm-hmm. And the folks who are making these decisions inside our nation's newsroom, you know, what sort of disparity do we have?
And the value that's placed on blonde hair, blue eyes.
Precisely.
And
when you look
moms.
At our newsrooms and you look at the relative lack of diversity, even now, and this is something I was saying, you know, we've been aware of this for dozens of years now. There still is a relative disparity in our nation's newsrooms. So
in terms of who's deciding what is news.
I'm sorry?
No, to your point, deciding what is news, the people who make those decisions.
Exactly. And at a very subconscious level, it shouldn't come as any surprise to us. And I don't think there are blatantly nefarious reasons why this is occurring. It's natural that someone can understand and relate to people who look more familiar to them, people who look like the folks who sit around the kitchen table, for example, and you know that you know, the people who we go and play soccer with, the people in our neighborhoods who are our friends and cousins. It makes sense that we would relate to that, mm-hmm. and that if there is also a disproportionate number. If diversity isn't necessarily reflected to the extent that it could be in our nation's newsrooms, that our decision makers are some of this is being reflected as our decision makers in you know the newsrooms, the editors are selecting cases that they can relate to, cases that touch them in a different way.
And in the meantime,
this is not to say that's an inherently racist. Because I know enough of my colleagues to know that this is not the case. But there certainly is a racial component when we see, which of these stories matter to us. There's also this too, you know, how those stories are covered. Even when we decide, okay, well, you know, if we clear that hurdle where we decide, okay, this case of a missing black girl, for example, does matter. Is newsworthy. Now there become disparities on how we cover that. So we're news coverage of missing black women. You're gonna be likely to see how that those sort of stories are gonna focus on you know the victims. All of the baggage that the victim
yes.
and her background that she brings. You know, did she have boyfriends who beat her up?
Even
did she come from a troubled past?
So even as you make the case that clearing that first hurdle that yes, this is a story our viewing audience should hear. Then we move on to the victim and the portrayal of the victim in the news media. And you're saying there's a difference between the way the victim is portrayed, even in the midst of her family's suffering.
Right. And this becomes a matter of how the entire apparatus of missing persons work. So it's not just a matter of how the stories are covered from the journalist's point of view, but also how law enforcement understands that. The rate and rapidity at which they pursue something has a lot to do with the perception that they bring to the case. So if you believe that a missing woman has had abusive boyfriends, if she's had trouble in her past, the way you report that story and the way you go about investigating that case is different than if you presume that, you know, these are our girlfriends and mothers and daughters, as is usually as is usually the persuasion and as we understand it with white victims. You come at that differently, and if you come at things differently, it's often likely that you're going to have a different outcome.
That is such an excellent point. That is a very distressing point, but it's one that we certainly need to discuss, and I'm sure you're covering that in the article that you're writing for the Village Celebration. Thank you for joining us for the preview of your article that we will have later this week. What else are you working on, Jonathan?
Well, as always, I'm blogging at my personal blog, which is Couldn't Keep It to Myself, which you can find at couldn'tkeepit.wordpress.org. I'm sorry, did I say .org? couldn'tkeepit.wordpress.com.
Okay.
And and we'll continue to do contributing pieces to the Village Celebration as well.
We look forward to having you join us again. Thank you so much. And we will read your article in the villagecelebration.com. Jonathan Clark, contributor to the Village Celebration. We're back in a moment. The contents of this broadcast are the exclusive property of the Village Celebration. Any duplication, rebroadcast, or any other use is strictly prohibited, and it is not permitted without the express written consent of the Village Celebration.